the state's budget surplus is growing. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about a whitefish project ranked number one in the nation. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the CEO of one of the Northwest's largest timber companies about the past, present, and future of his industry. Analysts expect Montana's budget surplus to be slightly higher than previous predictions. The estimate comes from the Legislative Fiscal Division. It now predicts the state will have nearly $353 million left in the bank at the end of this budget cycle. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says that's almost $6 million higher than estimates in December.
The Montana legislature passes a budget every 2 years. It's a forecast estimating how much money the state will be bringing in and how much will be spent. In the time between when lawmakers pass one budget and tackle the next one 2 years later, in that between time, the Legislative Finance Committee meets every couple months to see how things are going. Conrad Republican Senator Lou Jones chairs the Finance Committee.
Like anything, when you forecast 2 years out, things tend to change. And it's always nice if you stay relatively close to the forecast.
It is almost the same as what we showed you in December again.
And so far, as the budget nears its halfway mark, it's been really close to what was passed by lawmakers in 2013. You're hearing Amy Carlson with the State Legislative Fiscal Division briefing the lawmakers on the budget. Basically, the state's budget is about $2 billion a year. And right now, things are off only by a couple million dollars. And Senator Jones says that slight discrepancy is in the state's benefit right now.
Revenues are actually slightly higher. Expenses are slightly lower. Nothing major, but we're right on track.
There are a lot of little reasons for these positive budget changes, but not everything is positive. There are a couple of agency budgets lawmakers on the Finance Committee are watching closely. The Office of the State Public Defender is looking to be $2 million in the hole by the end of this budget cycle, partly due to an increase in caseloads for the state's defense attorneys. Also, the Department of Public Health and Human Services expects to be over $9 million in the hole. Great Falls Democratic Senator and committee member Mitch Tropila says those shortfalls are no real cause for alarm at this point.
But it's nice to know about money issues earlier rather than later. And it's like anybody, you have a checkbook, I have a checkbook. You always have to check your balances and you always have to take stock of where you're at.
The Legislative Finance Committee will be taking stock of the state's checkbook again in a couple months. Lawmakers will begin the next budget setting process next January. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, the Republican Party in Yellowstone County says it will not allow congressional candidate Drew Turiano to speak at a party event this weekend, saying they will not give him a platform for his racist views. Party chairwoman Jennifer Owens says the party asked Turiano not to attend its Lincoln-Reagan Day dinner on Saturday. All other major candidates for statewide office will have a chance to speak at the dinner, which is expected to draw about 300 people. Turiano told the Billings Gazette he is being turned away because he is a self-described member of the Tea Party. He allowed that Owen might have been offended by his support for Operation Wetback, a proposal to deport all immigrants living in the country illegally along with their American-born children.
Documents obtained by the Associated Press show that failings exposed last spring in an Air Force nuclear missile base were worse than originally reported. Those responsible for missile operations at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, passed an inspection in March 2013 with a marginal rating. But that was only because of good marks received by cooks and other support staff. Launch officers entrusted with keys to 150 Minuteman III missiles did poorly and would have flunked the inspection. The documents also hint at the makings of an exam cheating problem among launch crews at Minot months before allegations of widespread cheating erupted in January at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls. The Air Force documents were released to a group called Speak Truth to Power, which shared them with the AP.
The number of carloads of crude oil U.S. railroads delivered last year surged 83% over 2012 as concerns about the shipments grow. The Association of American Railroads said today the major U.S. railroads delivered 434,042 carloads of crude oil in 2013. That's well above the 236,556 carloads of crude oil railroads delivered in 2012. Crude oil shipments remain a relatively small part of rail traffic, but they have grown significantly since 2008, when 9,344 carloads were delivered. Three fiery derailments involving crude oil in the past year led to increased concerns about the shipments, even though railroads' overall safety record remains good. The worst of those killed 47 people in Quebec. Federal regulators are also considering requiring upgrades to the tank cars railroads use.
The Montana Supreme Court says the property of Faith Lutheran Church in Great Falls belongs to a minority group that opposed the church's split with its national denomination in 2010. The court ruled unanimously yesterday the church's constitution requires 90% of members to vote for a split for the property to go with them. 71% of Faith Lutheran members approved the break with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America after the denomination approved the ordination of gay ministers. They kept the church's name and property. Half of those who voted to stay with the national denomination formed the New Hope Lutheran Ministry, which sued for control of the church's property and a foundation. The High Court ruled the foundation is independent and not part of the church property.
The U.S. Forest Service ranks a whitefish project involving drinking water, recreation, and logging as a number one priority in the nation. Katrin Fry reports this means the project takes a big funding step forward toward turning what's been a neighborly understanding into official policy.
The Haskell Basin project encompasses about 3,000 acres of the F.H. Stoltz Lumber Company's land. Whitefish Mayor John Mulfeld says it's a popular recreation area, and it also supplies 75% of the city's water.
Stoltz has allowed the city access to our municipal water diversions in Haskell Creek as a neighborly accommodation, and to date, those access agreements haven't been codified or even memorialized between Stoltz and the city of Whitefish.
The city is looking to make this agreement official and keep it that way by buying up the development rights to the land. Whitefish teamed up with the Trust for Public Lands to find a way to preserve this land as a source of water and recreation, and also as a working forest.
And from an economic standpoint, it's important that we keep these working forests as working forests, and we put folks to work in the woods, and we keep the lumber mills locally supplied with forest products, and that's important for our local economy.
Northern Rockies Director Deb Love with the Trust for Public Lands says Stoltz has been an incredible neighbor, but also notes this land knocks up against former Stoltz land that's now part of the Whitefish Mountain Resort and the exclusive Iron Horse development.
These forest lands are highly developable. In fact, across the country, for the Forest Legacy Program, which provides funding for conservation easements on working forest land, they look at what is the development threat on these lands. And Haskell Basin was ranked number one in the entire country for forest legacy funding.
Buying the development rights comes with a $17 million price tag. The U.S. Forest Service announced a $7 million forest legacy grant to the Haskell Basin project. It also identifies the Whitefish project as a number one priority. Love says that's out of 44 other projects nationwide.
We're in the crown of the continent, which is considered one of the most intact ecosystems in the world, and certainly in the lower 48 states. We still have all the incredible charismatic megafauna, the grizzly bears and the lynx, that other places have lost. And the Haskell Basin Project has all those wildlife values.
Love says the agreement they're working on puts a conservation easement on the land, ensuring public access, but keeping it in private ownership.
This agreement ensures that the community will continue to have that crystal clear water to drink and that the community will get to enjoy these lands for recreation. But it's also important nationally for the incredible wildlife habitat that whitefish enjoys.
The city still has to raise $10 million. Mulfeld says the city is hoping to win an additional $2 million from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Habitat Conservation Program. He says the city put together a working group to collaborate with the Trust for Public Lands and the city's conservation arm, Whitefish Legacy Partners, to go to the public and figure out how private and public funding can complete the project. Mulfeld says they hope to have it wrapped up in the next year and a half. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Montana Insurance Commissioner Monica Lindeen said today the former Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana has paid a $250,000 fine for violations uncovered during an audit completed last summer. The market conduct exam revealed the company had a business practice until late 2010 of processing some emergency care claims at the out-of-work network coinsurance rate of 40%, rather than the 50% rate listed in the policy, unless the insured filed an appeal. The audit also found that BCBS entered into an agreement with an association in April 2009 in which the bills it sent to employer groups also included the costs of an association member life insurance policy, an employee assistance program, and an administrative fee. BCBS returned the extra money to the association but reported it as a commission. State law requires premiums for each type of insurance to be billed separately.
Montana's decision to let migrating bison roam across 70,000 acres of land outside Yellowstone National Park stands. The Montana Supreme Court said Tuesday it would not rule in the case because Park County raised a different issue on appeal than it did in its initial petition in district court. The county's petition argued the wandering bison were a public nuisance. A separate petition by the Park County Stock Growers Association and the Montana Farm Bureau Federation argued the expansion violated a 2011 law that prohibited state wildlife officials from releasing wild bison on private or public land without the owner's permission. District Judge E. Wayne Phillips ruled against both arguments in January 2013. The county appealed Phillips' interpretation that the 2011 law did not apply to bison wandering out of the park, not their initial claim the bison were a public nuisance.
A helicopter crew from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota came to the rescue of two men stranded in a truck on a flooded river in eastern Montana. The base says the crew with the 54th Helicopter Squadron had just finished a training flight about midnight Monday when they received the call for help. The four crew members flew to the scene near Savage, Montana, where the men had been stranded by river ice jam flooding for about 5 hours. The crew hoisted the two men into the helicopter and flew them to the airport in Sydney, where emergency medical workers were waiting. The men were fine. Captain Matthew Sutliff says he's proud of his team.
A Butte man has been sentenced to nearly 19 years in federal prison for selling a prescription pain-relieving patch to a man who died of an overdose in December 2012. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 21-year-old Dakota Rogers was sentenced on February 21st by U.S. District Judge Sam Haddon in Butte. Rogers earlier pleaded guilty to distribution of fentanyl. Prosecutors say Rogers sold a fentanyl patch to 23-year-old Mark Philip Allen for $35. An autopsy found Allen died early on December 8, 2012, as a result of fentanyl toxicity. Fentanyl is a powerful synthetic opiate used to manage moderate to severe pain for patients who don't get enough relief from morphine or oxycodone. Court records say Rogers acknowledged selling the fentanyl patch to Allen and teaching him how to smoke it.
Two Great Falls residents face child endangerment charges after a hair sample from their 8-month-old child and three other school-aged children who lived with them tested positive for drugs. The Great Falls Tribune reports Anthony Freeman and Sarah Hamrick were arrested this week after an investigation by the Russell Country Drug Task Force. They reportedly told law enforcement officers that their babysitter must have exposed the baby to drugs. But an investigation found the couple knew the babysitter used meth and had at times given the drug to her as payment. Court records say Freeman told investigators that Hamrick used a good amount of meth, including in their residence on some occasions when the children were present.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell plans to join U.S. Senator John Tester on a tour of Montana over the weekend to discuss the economic benefits of outdoor recreation and tourism on public lands, energy development, and upholding trust responsibilities to American Indians. Tomorrow morning, they are scheduled to visit the Crow Indian Reservation and tour the site where the tribe plans to develop a hydropower project. That evening, Jewell and Tester are scheduled to participate in a public discussion on conservation, public lands, and natural resources in Bozeman. On Saturday, they are scheduled to tour the Rolling Stone Ranch near Ovando and learn about the collaborative conservation efforts involved in the Blackfoot Challenge. On Sunday, Jewell plans to visit Glacier National Park, and then both will stop at the Fort Peck Indian Reservation.
Darby musher Jesse Royer finished 7th in this year's Iditarod, clocking her fastest time and her best finish in 11 tries. The Ravalli Republic reports Royer finished the race Tuesday, covering the 1,100-mile trail from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska in 9 days, 4 hours, 3 minutes, and 25 seconds. She finished with 10 of the 16 dogs she started with. Several veteran mushers scratched from the race because the course lacked snow and strong winds pushed mushers sideways as they tried to cross the ice-covered ocean.
Mike Covey went to work for the Plum Creek Timber Company right after getting his forestry degree from the University of Montana in 1980 and stayed with Plum Creek for 23 years. Covey is now chairman and CEO of the Spokane-based Potlatch Corporation, another big timber holder in the Pacific Northwest. Covey was in Missoula this week to lecture at his alma mater, and he also took time to sit down in our studios with News Director Sally Mock to talk about the sweeping changes in the timber industry in the last few decades.
Certainly for western Montana and northern Idaho, a lot of impacts on local economies as sawmills and production facilities have closed, and the supply from both private and public lands has dwindled. So I think, you know, pretty huge impacts to a lot of rural communities in the West. At the same time, a transformation of the land base that's always been kind of available for public use and largely stays that way today. So I think western Montanans and northern Idahoans are pretty fortunate in that regard. They have the privilege of using a very large private asset for public use and enjoyment in most degrees, whenever they want.
And there's great debate about why the supply did dwindle. And the debate sort of goes in the simplistic form that it dwindled because the Forest Service really stopped putting timber up for sale. And another view of it is the Forest Service went to true multiple use and stopped being just a timber agency.
Well, I'm not an expert on the Forest Service, although my father spent his career with the U.S. Forest Service and the National Forest System. I'm fortunate to be the son of a forester that graduated from the University of Montana as well. So, and our daughter is the third generation here. But, I don't think that the answer is clear. That I think the national forests have always been managed for multiple uses, and you could argue now that forestry certainly is one of the multiple uses that's being undermanaged. And fire and other things have taken the place of active management in much of the national forest system.
Not necessarily by choice, but by circumstance of our changing climate and so on.
Yeah, I think to some degree that's true. Changing climate certainly had something to do with that. At the same time, private forests for a long time in the West have been over-harvested to kind of make up for the lack of supply that used to previously come from public lands. So you had this kind of confluence of social changes with the management of the national forests, which are subject to congressional and public opinion and oversight, and private forests that have been harvested at a rapid rate and now need to recover. And so as a result, there's a pinch. There's no supply, and the industry changes. But the nice thing is it's a renewable resource. Sometimes we forget that. The trees will grow back, and there will be a thrifty supply of trees coming again, and whether those are going to be used for the forest products industry or for other purposes remains to be seen.
A lot of those private forest lands in Potlatch, I think it's true of Potlatch as well, have been turned into development, that many of the timber companies have become real estate developers as well, including Potlatch.
Well, to a very small degree, in our company, we have about 1.4 million acres of timberland, and we've identified about 200,000 of those 1.4 million acres that'll eventually be sold for higher values. In many cases, those are people that are going to buy 40 acres or 100 acres of land to put a private cabin on or to use for recreational purposes like skiing or hunting or other uses. And so a very small portion of the land I think will ever be developed in the sense of a housing unit or anything else on it.
But it's good for the company's bottom line, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think there's just no way that we can grow and compete and buy more timberland if we don't consider the fact that in any large block of timberland, there are going to be components that have more valuable uses than growing trees. And in order to compete for that land and own it and to provide a return to our shareholders, we have to consider that in the equation. And it isn't, you know, the higher and better use values can be captured by people that have no plans for development. We've done deals with the Nature Conservancy, with the Trust for Public Land.
Lots of conservation easements.
Conservation easements that all add, we get paid a value for that represents a complement to the underlying timber value if we've sold those rights. But I think the property still ends up in a very favorable outcome for recreational use or public use and those kinds of things. So I don't view it as simply a win-lose. It's bad for this and it's good for that. I think there's always a blend and a mix.
In terms of the industry where it is right now, with the housing industry bouncing back, timber prices are pretty good right now, and It's kind of a mini boom going on in your industry, fair to say?
Fair to say, and we think it's only going to get better. You know, housing last year was just under 1 million starts roughly in the country. If you look at the Harvard Joint Study for Housing and other econometric forecasts, it's going to take somewhere between 1.6 and 1.9 million housing starts just to keep up with demographic change, household formations, homes that are falling apart need replaced, and so on. And if we're at a little less than 1 million starts right now, we see a pretty favorable trajectory going forward with increased demand for housing, which means strong lumber pricing, strong demand for logs, and of course, the wild card in that is the economy going to support that, and will interest rates and if home affordability remain, sustainable for people, or will they get choked out? But so far, we think we're in the early innings of a pretty favorable return. We had one of our best years ever in 2013, and we think 2014 will be even better still.
A lot of talk about the future of biofuels. Do you see Potlatch getting into biofuels?
Absolutely. It's an emerging. There's about over 400 plants in the country, and most of those are being targeted in the area of wood pellets. And those are wood pellets for industrial production, usually to be exported currently to the United Kingdom and to Europe for coal, co-firing in a coal plant. That's kind of a tongue twister. But burned alongside coal. Europe and the UK have a mandate for 20% renewable energy by 2020, and wood pellets constitute the major source of that supply. And so there's plants being built throughout the U.S. South today for that purpose. Locally, there's projects that I think have fit. There's a new plant started in Columbia Falls, Montana, by Stoltz Lumber Company in the last year that burns wood. And, I think one of the real barriers to that and challenges we have is with the EPA and what's called the tailoring rule, and the notion that so far EPA has determined that the carbon emissions from the combustion of wood are really classified no differently than the carbon emissions from fossil fuels like coal. And that just makes no sense to us when you have a renewable energy, a new renewable resource that can be replaced on a cycle of 50 to 100 years or even shorter than that in some parts of the country. So I think the continuation of wood biomass alternative uses for wood in addition to building products really depends on a favorable energy policy from Congress.
Everybody wants an energy policy from whatever point of view they're coming from.
Absolutely. Certainty is good, and we need one. And I think renewable energy in terms of wood and wind and solar and hydro and others all need, we need more clarification about that in terms of meeting the country's energy needs going forward.
Of course, a lot of factors going into all those decisions, but one thing for sure about your industry is it is an industry of change, and that will continue.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been one of, I wouldn't say rapid change, but kind of decadal changes, whether it's employment, impacts in local and rural communities, emerging opportunities like this biomass one we just talked about. We're on the cutting edge of another one of Potlatch with the sale of carbon credits. That's a new business for us, and it's a very small one, but one that we think has potential. We have a 15,000 acre forest in Arkansas that we have set aside for the conservation of red-cockaded woodpeckers, an endangered species. We were able at the same time, because the trees are not going to be harvested in the next 100 years, we've been able to set aside and get paid for the carbon credits that are being created by the preservation of that forest. And those have a market, and the market's emerging in California. And again, it's all part of these all part of the energy standards and energy policy. So it is change. It happens all the time.
We have been speaking with Mike Covey, who's chairman and CEO of the Potlatch Corporation based in Spokane, Washington. Mr. Covey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect from noon tomorrow to 9 a.m. Saturday for the West Glacier region, the lower Clark Fork region, and the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 19 to 26 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. For central Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow in the mountains and highs 45 to 50 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett.
Much has been said about the appointment of John Walsh to the U.S. Senate, including comparisons to Montana's earlier Senate appointments. It's interesting to look at the actual historical facts of the earlier situations. Most recently, 36 years ago, Paul Hatfield, then Montana's new Supreme Court Chief Justice, was appointed by Governor Tom Judge to replace Senator Lee Metcalf, who had passed away. I recall this process well, having been an aide to the governor and a friend of Hatfield. After his strong election to the Supreme Court in 1976, Hatfield naively accepted the Senate appointment, assuming he had some electoral strength. However, then-Congressman Max Baucus had been actively preparing for a run for Metcalf's seat because Senator Metcalf had made it clear all along that he would not run again. As a result, Hatfield was only in the Senate for a little over 4 months before Baucus overwhelmed him in the 1978 primary election by more than a 3-to-1 margin. Now, the appointment before that was more nefarious. In 1933, when Senator Thomas Walsh unexpectedly died while on a train to Washington to become FDR's Attorney General, Governor John Erickson was just beginning his third term. Erickson is the only Montanan elected governor 3 times. Erickson ambitiously seized the opportunity, resigned the governorship, and had his lieutenant governor appoint him to the open Senate seat, though Erickson only held it for 2 years. However, the much earlier saga of Montana Copper King W.A. Clark's naked ambition for money and power, including 5 separate tries for a U.S. Senate seat, is a true Montana melodrama. Right after Montana became a state, its first legislature did not actually convene, but the Democrats and Republicans each met separately and elected 2 separate sets of senators. Clark was one of the Democrats so elected, but when he presented his credentials to the U.S. Senate in January of 1890, the Senate, then controlled by Republicans, turned him down and seated the 2 Republicans. Clark's second unsuccessful attempt was when Montana's 3rd legislature refused to support him because of his ongoing feud with the other major Copper King, Marcus Daly, and no one was picked by the legislature. So Governor Rickards then appointed Lee Mantle a Republican, but the U.S. Senate, then controlled by Democrats, refused to seat Mantle, leaving Montana without a senator again for 2 years. Clark's 3rd go at getting into the Senate was in the 6th legislature, an effort that was notable for Clark's outright bribery, so well documented in Montana history books. But after taking the Senate seat, 4 months later, on May 15, 1900, Clark resigned while a vote was pending in the U.S. Senate on a resolution to remove him from office because of the blatant bribery. But Clark's resignation was not really a capitulation. Clark forces in Montana had concocted a scheme that drew Governor Robert Smith to California. While he was gone, the lieutenant governor, a Clark ally, appointed Clark to the open seat that had been created by his own resignation, and did so on the very same day that Clark had resigned. When the governor heard about what happened, he immediately returned to Montana and rescinded the Clark appointment. Thus, Clark's 4th attempt to get a Senate seat failed. Governor Smith then named a different Democrat to the Senate seat, but the Senate declined to seat him, again creating a vacancy in the Montana U.S. Senate delegation that lasted for another year. The 7th legislature finally elected Clark to a 6-year Senate term in 1901 in his 5th attempt. This time, he was successful because, among other things, his Copper King rival, Marcus Daly, had died. According to noted Professor Ellis Waldron, quote, "The legislature again elected William A. Clark to the U.S. Senate, and he served an undistinguished term that satisfied his political ambitions," close quote. The Clark quest was quite the Montana melodrama. Notwithstanding the dramatic storyline, I suspect it was never made into a movie because there was no happy or heroic ending. Essentially, the villain of the piece finally got what he wanted. Now, these events at the turn of the 20th century were some real shenanigans regarding the U.S. Senate appointments here in Montana. To me, there is a huge difference between the naked ambition for power of Copper King Clark or the nefarious ambition of John Erickson and the 32 years of public service by John Walsh before he became a senator, including leading our National Guard in battle overseas. Any suggestions of similarity are unfair to Walsh, historically inaccurate, and probably politically motivated. Historical facts are stubborn things. This is Evan Barrett in Butte, thinking of Montana's real history when it comes to the U.S. Senate.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Connor tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.